Blog Talk Radio.
All right, everybody. It is Puck Chatter podcast radio thing. I am Chris Block, and alongside is my friend and colleague, and some people affectionately call Uncle Al, Al Simaglia. How you doing today, Al? Oh, see, look at that. Now you can say it. How you doing, Al?
Well, doing wonderful. Good to be with you.
Hey, you know, if one of these times I'm going to remember to unmute you. So, you know, we've been talking about doing this for a while. We finally got it done. You can thank Al for being very persistent. I am less persistent. But I'm glad we're here because there's a lot to talk about. I know people are going to want to hear, I did a quite a lengthy Kyle Beach story a while back, about a month ago now. I know some people are going to want to talk about that, but first, or they're going to want to hear us talk about it. But at first is more on the front of people's minds is the Blackhawks are now, that season is over with, thankfully for some people. And the Rockford IceHogs are also done. Unsurprisingly, the Rockford IceHogs got thoroughly walloped by the Chicago Wolves. And so it's all over with now. It's summertime, and we don't have to watch Blackhawks hockey anymore. But now the real stuff starts. And the Blackhawks are talking, a lot of talk about, you know, rebuilding and taking their time and all of that. But you know, as there is, I think, with the Blackhawks, there's what they say, and then maybe there's reality. And that's why we're here today. One of the things that I think is interesting with Kyle Davidson, and I want to start this by saying I don't know Kyle. I've sat next to him in the press box in Rockford a handful of times. You know, I think he seems like a nice guy. I think he's a smart guy from everything that I've heard. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting, and we should also talk. So Jeff Greenberg, baseball guy, son of a rich guy who wanted to buy a hockey team, didn't get to buy a hockey team, and now his son is going to get to work in hockey, Jeff Greenberg, hired by the Blackhawks as the associate general manager. He was in the finalist for the GM job. And this is very interesting to me how all this developed with Greenberg. For sure, it's a Jamie Faulkner win. That's interesting in itself when you think about the dynamic of this. I thought we were supposed to get away from the business side influencing the hockey ops side, but apparently we're not done with that. But fine, whatever, Jeff Greenberg, it's a fresh set of ideas. It can't hurt, but it's interesting to me that Kyle Davidson handed over a third of his job to somebody who can't be reasonably evaluated for 3 years. That's interesting. But the Blackhawks tell you that it was Kyle Davidson's idea. I don't buy it, but it's okay, Kyle. That's okay. But when you listen to Davidson and these guys talk, and they did a meet and greet. Did you see this the other day, Al? Davidson, Greenberg, and Norm McIver had a meet and greet with the overly friendly Chicago Blackhawks media, and everybody was all smiles and very happy, and they seem to be setting the table strategically smart on their part to give themselves an awful lot of runway here. And, oh, this is going to take a lot of time and all this and that. The elephant in the room is Patrick Kane, Seth Jones, Alex DeBrincat, and if you want to throw Taves in there, you can throw him in there. These are the guys that are going to determine really what the trajectory of your rebuild are. And you and I have talked about this before, but it's one thing to say these things, but those three of those guys that I just mentioned are three pieces. If you tear this thing down, Kane, DeBrincat, Jones, and if you're really rebuilding, then you need to part with probably two of those guys. If if you're really rebuilding, you're going to part with those guys, and then you're immediately looking for people that are going to – players who are going to replace those players. So it's very odd. But that appears to be at least where they're saying they're going.
Well, I guess we're going to find out shortly, I would imagine, within the next, 2 months, 6 weeks or so, into July, which seems to be the key time for a lot of decision-making on the Blackhawks, the head coach and everything else. I just look at it this way. And first off, for the lumberheads that keep trying to come back at me because I'm putting Kyle Davidson down. No, I don't know him. I don't know that much about him, except he was with Stan Bowman for the last I don't know how many years. Have nothing against him, and would hope someday he wins General Manager of the Year. I truthfully say that. But I'm not going to buy into anything until I see a plan, which they're nowhere near getting. They might be closer in time, but it still seems like by saying they keep putting a timeline of out there, years out there for a rebuild. My contention is this: no one times a rebuild. No one does. Okay? There's so many variables. And for those that weren't paying attention or weren't Blackhawk fans or whatever, the Hawks rebuild started because Dale Talon built probably the worst possible team coming out of the lockout for the new, air quotes, NHL. He did realize subsequently and not too long after that that was, in fact, the case after he top-ticked the goalie market with Nikolai Habibulin, who got paid more than any other goaltender at the time, with a team that was just full of holes. But that led to the conclusion that let's tank this thing, basically, or get bad. And they did. And a number of years later, due to some good scouting and other things and some development, emerged the foundation for the Blackhawks teams in the future for the Cup run. And the cornerstones
And real quick,
right.
The other thing to make, the point to be made about the 2005 team that you just referenced, is that was coming out of the lockout, but the decision to go that route and those free agents, and some of them were guided, and Dale made terrible, right? He pivoted real quick, and he got smart, and the people on his staff, Rick Dudley and such, were really, really smart people, and they pivoted, and they ended up in a much more optimistic and sufficient point. I want to make is that was heavily influenced by the work by Bifford, and they were going to come out of that lockout and make that was influenced by the works, which is an important point to make.
Yeah, and also the other point to make is it took years and millions of dollars of lost revenue. So pre-Taves, I was there, you know, with the other 4,000 or 5,000 people that were in attendance, and they started the student discount.
I was one of those people, yeah.
Right, with student discount for the $7 or $8 loss leader, which was probably the best marketing thing that Bill Wirtz ever did, because those same people years later became season ticket holders, a good portion of them. But my point is this: it went from building a team that was going to win the Stanley Cup. You don't pay like $6.5 million at that time. I think it was $6.5 million for Nikolai Habibulin at that time, just to put a Band-Aid team together to get better. You know, he was a cup winner and everything else. They reached for him. He got him. He paid up to get him. So that was all wrong. As it turned out, what they did subsequently turned out to be right. Many years later, the cornerstones, as I was saying, was two young defensemen that were taught the right way and were able to withstand playing a good amount of minutes and brutal teams, Keith and Seabrook. And then came the good fortune of making the right pick with Taves and then getting extremely lucky to have a chance at Kane. And then a number of other players, and they got very good very quick. Okay, that's all well and good. Dale Talen tried the same thing in Florida. And ironically, what cost him his job ultimately, I think, one of the things is he top-ticked the goalie market with Bobrovsky. But it's not that easy. It's not like a game plan. What I don't understand, well, I do understand it, but what bothers me is people think of a rebuild the same as a tank. At any one time, there's probably a third of the teams doing in some form of rebuild. A tank is the Arizona Coyotes. And you do that because you don't have anything there that's worth really saving, and you make sure that you get to the bottom. The New York Rangers, that was a rebuild. They sent the letter out, but if you look at what was on their team then, they didn't have really three players at the time that were of the value of Kane, and I know he's getting older, but he still is what he is, DeBrincat and Jones. And if you go through the whole Western Conference, if you were to go onto every team and bundle what you think is the three best players and have to pick between DeBrincat, Kane, and Jones, in a number of cases, probably the majority of the time, you're going to say, gee, I don't really feel comfortable not picking Kane, Jones, and DeBrincat. So right now, they're in an uncomfortable position because they're starting a bit upside down. Now, hindsight is 20/20. I said a lot of things that didn't work out, but I did say about 3 years ago that if you're going to do this and want to get better and almost guarantee yourself that you're going to lose some games in the interim to get some better draft picks, the one guy who you could have traded for value was Duncan Keith, and they didn't do that. So they are where they are now, and I agree with what you said to a degree. You said unless they probably trade two of the three. If they don't trade two of the three, then they're on a slippery slope to nowhere.
They're doing the same thing to Stan Bowman. There's been a lot of
right.
Like smarmy comments about what's the way Stan and Stan has. I mean, the decisions that the old regime made have put Kyle Davidson fairly, to be fair to Kyle and Danny Wirtz to an extent, yeah, because Danny Wirtz is skirting responsibility for what happened last summer when he shouldn't have. He was at the helm. If he could have stopped it, but he didn't. You know, he let Stan do those things, and Danny Wirtz doesn't get any criticism for it, and he should, because he was in charge, and he stood by and he let Stan Bowman do that stuff. So it speaks to his lack of hockey acumen that he stood by and said, yeah, go ahead and do all that stuff. Yeah, go ahead and extend Jeremy Colliton, who's never done a damn thing. It's Danny Wirtz should be getting criticized and he's not. But the point I want to make real quick is there's been smarmy comments directed towards Stan and the old guard, and a lot of those are deserved. But if you are rebuilding, then you have to trade Patrick Kane, because if you don't, then you're not in a full rebuild. You're doing exactly what Stan did. If you let Kane walk for nothing, you're doing exactly what Stan did. All this other talk is just noise. And yes,
it's almost a perfect storm in a way. You know, from the standpoint of this, what happened to them with the beach thing and all that other stuff, right? Which much of it was because of their own doing. But with the money they had from the long-term injury reserve with Seabrook and Shaw and everything, almost every NHL GM would have said, if you have a chance of taking a guy that could play 25 minutes a night and you could build your back end around, and he's in his mid-20s or so, you take a swing, because they were correct. They don't come around that often. So getting Seth Jones, and people say, well, no, they shouldn't have got him, was too early. Well, what was too early? If they didn't get Seth Jones, are they trading Taves? Are they trading Kane? Are they trading DeBrinket? Are they doing any of that? So they got Seth Jones. Now it's to the point where, you know, you got to live with what you did. And I think if they don't get rid of two of the three, they'll probably be in a terrible position where they'll be just about as bad as they were this year, because I can't, and no worse, because I cannot imagine them getting a more incompetent coaching staff than they've had for the last 4 or 5 years.
Okay, and before
so
we move on.
That's my reasoning.
Before, because I want to, just the point you just made, before we move on, because I think it's really important, and it's an aspect of this whole situation that is very much under-talked about. And you mentioned Seth Jones. And I thought, from the very beginning, I thought the Seth Jones trade was the right thing to do because, number one, the Blackhawks, if you can't develop your own defenseman, then you have to go out and get one. I mean, what are we talking about here? Like, they have a complete inability for a decade to develop a defenseman. So what are you left to do? You have to go out and get one that's already developed, and they went out and did it. And then there are all these people that are falling all over themselves and say what a horrible thing it was, and how horrible Seth Jones is. And a lot of those people, ironically, at the end of this last season, I saw in the last like month or so, were like wanting to go on record as saying, oh, he wasn't bad. Oh, he actually was fine and all this. The ironic part about it is Seth Jones, the last 6 weeks of the season was terrible. But that was his worst stretch of the whole season. He was awful. And the reason for it is because he wasn't being coached. And I come back to this all the time. The Blackhawks, how good would they have been this year if they had competent coaching? And before you, and it's a discussion to be had. I'm not saying that they would have been a playoff team, because I don't think they would have. But how close would they have been had they had competent coaching? You had those three players that we talked about. You had a Hall of Fame goaltender who, outside of the first month of the season, had a really good run with you in Chicago, Marc-Andre Fleury. How good you have been? I watched the Calgary Flames. That defense, how they're the best team in the West. Daryl Sutter is the coach of the year by far. I don't want to hear anything else about it, because if you take that Calgary Flames defense and put it on the Blackhawks aren't any better than they were. And it speaks to competent coaching. The Blackhawks haven't had competent coaching since they got rid of Joe Quenneville. And it may have been time for Joe Quenneville to leave. It may have been time for a different voice, but they have had terrible coaching ever since. They have terrible coaching. Nah, it's a terrible. They don't have great coaching in Rockford. They've had terrible coaching in Chicago, and that's a part of this story. So to say, okay, we've got to tear this whole thing down, but you have three of the pieces already. Yes, you need to develop better. Yes, you need to draft better. But you were drafting sort of okay because you were acquiring players, Gustav Forsling and others, that wound up being good NHL players on other teams. You just let them go. You didn't develop them, and you let them go. The problem here is coaching, development, and evaluation. Tear the whole thing down because, I mean, everybody loves to be fantasy GM, but tearing the whole thing down, it doesn't guarantee anything. The Blackhawks needed to win the lottery, the draft lottery, to get Patrick Kane. They could have easily have drafted Phil Kessel instead of Jonathan Taves. You got to give Dale Talon and Rick Dudley a lot of credit for that. It's no guarantee just because you get great picks, Kirby Dach, that you're going to have great returns. So before you do this, you have to have some serious internal conversations about, wait a minute, if we just had competent coaching, not even great coaching, Jeremy Colleton, nice guy, I think he's a smart guy, He's not a great NHL coach. It was too soon, and it set this franchise. Who knows? You made the point on Twitter a while back that and I think it was a friend of ours, Sam Fels, said that you were over exaggerating. You weren't over exaggerating. Jeremy Colleton set this organization back at least 5 years. Stan Bowman and Jeremy Colleton sent it back at least 5 years. That decision was the worst, and the decision to extend him were the worst decisions that Stan Bowman ever made. And
they extended him while other very good tenured coaches had to wait till the COVID season ended.
And it's worrisome that Kyle Davidson talking about this idea of timelines. Kyle Davidson appears to be in no hurry to hire a coach. And it's like, if he already has his guy, like, I don't know how he would have that already, unless it's somebody that's already a proxy of the organization. But if he already has his guy,
it's got to be someone who's no one else's guy. It's got to be someone
right,
who's no one else's
is,
guy.
Which is worrisome, because that's exactly where you wound up with Jeremy Colleton. And the idea, and this is the other thing, when I see people write that it doesn't matter who the next coach is, you're not going to be good anyway, no, stop saying that. Because the rebuild, you want to talk about rebuild, the rebuild does not begin until the tanking ends, period. If you are intentionally being bad, this is how teams that intentionally, Arizona, how they're always bad. They never get good. Until you're done saying, okay, we're done being bad. Like, you don't want anybody who you really like in Rockford to come up and play in that environment. What did I just say with Seth Jones? Seth Jones, erratic, just out there, no structure at all. He's developing bad habits in front of your very eyes. And you cannot continue to let that go. And he's a veteran. You cannot continue to let that go.
It's happened here consistently.
Right. Go ahead.
I'm sorry to cut you off. It just happened here consistently. If you look at the pattern, they get a little bit of a run. Then they get bad. They stay bad. They get worse. And Colleton, what would he do? He would let them do basically what they want to do. So they would, you know, sacrifice, not be as attentive defensively because they don't know, they don't have the structure to play well defensively. They're not the first team to three, because when they try to play a tighter game, they can't score three goals. And then when they open it up, they still lose against the better teams 5-4. So, but with the 5-4 losses, the Brinkett's still scoring, Kane's still scoring, they're getting their points. It's a better product to watch for most people. And then you could have the guys on TV afterwards say, well, if it wasn't for these two correctable mistakes, we could have won those games. Hard to make that assessment, although that assessment is you could shoot a lot of holes in it, because a hockey is a game of mistakes. That's how you score usually, by someone else's mistakes. But you can't make that assessment as easily to promote and to puff things up when you're losing 3-1, 4-1, when you don't score. So it's been the same pattern all along. It's the Indians running, or the inmates running the asylum, I should say. And that's what's going on. That's what's happening. Now, when they traded Fleury, it's Seth Jones' play. He's too loose. He's doing whatever he has to do. He's trying to compete. He's trying to do well. And for those that don't understand this and want to just look at different stats and analytics, there is no other, beside a goaltender in some respects, dependent upon others, there is no other position that's dependent upon the right partner, about the right structure, of the ability to excel is a defender, is a defenseman. Now, perfect example. Darnell Nurse. Normally very good defenseman. Now, granted he was hurt, might not be 100%. When you watch him, when things go sideways, he's not the best defender on the team. He's all over the map. It's similar to Seth Jones. Getting back to, why do you pay a guy like Seth Jones? Well, the comp was Pietrangelo. if you think you're getting a player like that, that's decent or better than average defensively, can come through in the clutch and carry a team and can stir the offense, that's what you have to go out and do that. Because pretty much every team that wins the Cup has that guy and one other defender that's almost as good. That seems to be the roadmap. Just like with this tear-down rebuild, the teams that have been the most successful winning the Cup in the last number of years are teams that drafted back-to-back or very close to back-to-back Hall of Fame players and pretty much first-ballot Hall of Fame players. So that's a tough formula to fulfill. You don't have to necessarily sacrifice one for the other. If you try to get better now with the product on the ice, you could still build up your farm system. You could still do better drafting. This is a year where money's going to be tight with a lot of teams. There's teams that are going to shake things up because they've consistently disappointed. And there's money issues. Pittsburgh could be one. Boston could be one. Winnipeg is probably one. Minnesota, one of their better players, they probably can't re-sign in Fiala. This is a season to sit back and say, maybe I could take advantage of somebody else's distress and look at it that way. Not to necessarily see, we got time, you know, we'll take our time to rebuild this. Dale Talon said exactly the same thing. We're not going to rush because when we get good, we're going to want to stay good. Everybody says the same thing. That's what you want to do. It's not like you could just, it's not like a formula, like a recipe, like you're baking a cake. That's what you want to do. But there's examples of teams that have gotten better with small, what seem to be kind of not necessarily off the radar, but not big splashes. I watched the Kings a lot this year because I was interested to see Danault, that signing. Obviously a better player than most thought all the way around. They put him on the power play a little bit. He's still very good defensively. He's not the guy that you want to count on to score 40 goals, but he's an excellent player. And coming off a long run into the playoffs last year, he had a big season. Now you look at you talk about coaching. You look at the Kings. The Kings used 13 different defensemen. They lost one of their best defensemen before the season even started, Walker. They lost, and Doughty was gone for a good majority of the season. They went into the playoffs with a backbone of their defense being Olimata and Troy Stetcher. Those were the veteran influences they had. They had guys coming up from the AHL that they used. So let me just fast forward in this way. The idea is to stay bad as short as possible in time. The reason being, you want the younger guys that you're bringing up and the nucleus of the team that you're trying to form, you want them to play important games, not only for experience sake, which is valuable experience, but you also want to use those games to judge them and to grade them. Some guys, when the going gets tough, they don't want the ball. Other guys do. You have no chance of seeing that and being able to formulate, categorize players and to evaluate players unless you see them play under stressful situations. So it's as important as it is for the player to get valuable experience, which the Hawks have played a handful of important games over the last I don't know how many years. As important it is for the players, it's also very important for the people that should be watching closely, the coaches, the GM, so they could evaluate. So that's all I've got to say. All I know is this. If you'd put the Dallas Stars coaching staff, if you'd put the Los Angeles Kings coaching staff behind the Hawks bench this year, they don't finish where they finished, and they wouldn't be 21 points behind the team in front of them. Would they make the playoffs? No, but I think you would have found out a lot more about certain players than you do now, than you have under your belt now. You don't have the same sort of information coming to you because these games, what do they mean? And at the end of the day, when it's garbage time, players develop bad habits, and they start to get to be individuals. When you hear a player like Kirby Dach say, yeah, we're trying to evaluate, you know, amongst ourselves how we should play against different teams. That's not a direct quote. I'm paraphrasing. But he mentioned about the style of play that we should do against certain teams. Now, he's got, you know, 15 minutes in the league. And, by the way, from what I hear, not really highly thought of by the veteran group in the room. Take that for what it's worth. But when you hear a kid say that, what kind of leadership do they have? They have none. So that's the most important thing that Kyle Davidson may do this summer is to pick a head coach in the coaching and to get a coaching staff in place.
I think it's the most important thing. And because you can't – like Kirk Dach is – I'm willing to give Dach the benefit of the doubt. You know, that wrist injury was a nasty injury. He's had these like little starts and stops to his career so far COVID was one, the wrist injury is another, you know, all those things. But, the thing with him is like having him have this nice long summer to lead into next year is hugely important, but then having a good coaching staff to work with him at the end of that is going to be essential. I mean, it's critical to his development. Same with Lucas Reichel. Lucas Reichel, there are definitely things about his game that are exciting. You could see that he's a guy, he's exactly what they need. One of the things I'll say for Kyle Davidson, and I don't know how he gets this job without having these views, but the encouraging thing is, I mean, he was hired by Danny Wirt, so I don't know. But when he was talking with Lazarus and Powers on their podcast a while back, I was listening and I took some notes, and basically we're talking about who the players that they're looking to acquire in the future and all that. He mentioned they're looking for speed specifically down the middle. So, okay, you know what they think of Dylan Strome. And then he talked about high compete, high character. And he wants his team to play at a higher tempo. Higher tempo is really, it all starts on the back end. It's having players that could do what Brian Campbell used to do, which is get that puck and immediately move it up the ice. That was a critical component of those 2009-2010 Blackhawks teams that nobody really talks about anymore because Campbell wasn't, you know, he wasn't there, you know, he didn't continue with the group. But that's a critical component, and that's how you play fast tempo. If you watch these other teams that are successful, the defensemen get the puck and they move it. And it's crisp tape-to-tape passing. The Blackhawks don't have that, or they didn't have that up to this point. And that's, you can have all the speed you have up front, but if the defenseman on the back line can't get the puck to the forwards in a flow, then you don't really have speed up front. But that was interesting. I do want to say, before we go any further, I do have news. I don't know... I haven't been online the last couple of days, so I don't know if this has been reported, but the churn, sort of the changes, I apologize, the dog is going nuts. but there are some changes already in the Blackhawks front office, minor to most people, but to the surprise of not myself, senior advisor, player personnel, Pierre Gauthier is no longer with the organization. They've parted ways. And also, this one's sort of interesting, and my understanding is there's a story behind it, but I don't know what the story is. Andrei Nikolishin, who is their sort of hybrid Russian scout, he's gone. So I don't know what that means for potential, like, players that are in Russia potentially signing with the Blackhawks, but Andrei Nikolishin no longer with the Blackhawks.
Well, that Gauthier job, that could be a Brian Campbell job.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Or something like it, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking where Brian Campbell winds up. But yeah, those are the moves that have been made. And Davidson said basically, well, I think it was McIver that said that once they get through the draft, then you expect some movement on the amateur scouting side. All these people have contracts through the end of June anyway, so Most of them, I would assume. But this is what's exciting about a new regime and seeing what they do and evaluating. Because now there's going to be, they could say what they want, but once there's action, then you can really sort of read the tea leaves and see where they're actually going.
The defense has to change. The defense is the driver of the offense. And that's exactly pretty much the same thing that Talon would say. We want to play fast. We want to compete hard. That's what everyone really wants to do. The teams that do it the best are the teams that could skate the puck and pass it out of their zone and have forwards who are responsible and know where to lay pucks into the offensive zone, do a lot of different things that you don't see consistently here. But, like the Murphy's a nice player in some respects, but he's not a first-pairing player, and on a good team, he wouldn't be a top three. And he's really not very good. Well, he doesn't play the power play at all. And he's not very good. He's not a very good penalty killer. You see, that's a guy that Stan Bowman, he sunk his teeth into and then he extended him. So, to me, you have to change the defense up. I mean, when the next guy in line after Seth Jones to make a pass or to skate a puck up when he has space is his brother, not to be disparaging to him, and he is better than I thought he would be, but then in context, there's not much here to compare, his skill set to either. I mean, he at least moves the puck a bit. You're in trouble. So, I mean, DeHaan's not, I would think, wouldn't be here, but you got McCabe now signed through 2025, and you would hope he's better because he missed the year previously, but you got Connor Murphy signed for relatively not a bad contract, $4.4 million. I mean, you don't get a top pairing guy for that money. It's not that it's out of whack, but the trouble with him is, he's hurt a lot and concussions. And that's the one thing with Kirby Dach, he gets squared up. I mean, a lot. And Murphy gets hit a lot. Now, I don't know if Murphy is a chippy player and players come back at him, or if he's just vulnerable and they figure they might as well take a piece of this guy, because if they could take him out, he might be one of the better just steady defensemen that they have, which he is.
One of the reasons why players who get hit a lot are usually the players that they don't know what they're going to do with the puck before they get it. So,
and they don't have a lot of options because they can't skate it out of trouble.
So they get the puck and then they think, okay, what am I going to do with the puck? Whereas, I mean, and it's hard to find these players. That's a high level skill that, where as the puck is coming to you, you're surveying the scene and you realize, okay, what's the situation? All right, in this situation, I'm just going to bank it up the boards. Or in this case, I have a second to settle the puck and make a pass. That's one of the reasons why players who get hit a lot is because they don't have that skill. And with Murphy, he'll never have it because he's too far in now.
He's 29, right?
Yeah, he's not going to develop. Yeah. But that's an important thing with Dach is if he can't get out of that, then, it's probably never going to happen. He's not going to be, the quality of a number three overall draft pick, which is, look at Edmonton. Even when you do draft high every year, it doesn't guarantee you anything. And I want to move on to some different things, but, it does this idea. I just think that where we're headed is in a few years, all the articles are going to be the Blackhawks had DeBrincat, Jones, Patrick Kane, because Kane's going to be great for another few years, right? And they decided to get rid of those guys and start all over. And they, this could go so badly. And
for me, no offense to Kyle Davidson, like I said before, I think he's a smart guy. You know, does he deserve this chance right now? I don't think so. But the Wirtzes are comfortable with him. And, you know, and this, I would say this, if, you know, someone who's friends with Kyle and listening to this, I'll offer this fair, brief piece of advice. I think with Kyle, and this is what a lot of people, they're, you know, they're all excited about the rebuild because they're all fantasy GMs, right? This, if I'm Kyle Davidson, I have to have some self-awareness. One of the reasons why I got this job, if I'm Kyle Davidson, I have to admit to myself, is because the Blackhawks are comfortable with me. The Wirtzes are comfortable with me. So inherently, what does that mean? That means, I don't know how loud that is, but he's, somebody's at the door, I think. One of the reasons why I got this job is because the Wirtzes are comfortable with me. So inherently, that means that they're going to be comfortable at any time, just like we talked about with 2005 Dale Talon, walking into my office and saying, yeah, you know what, Kyle? We just lost another 2000 season ticket holders. This rebuild thing, not working. We got to pivot, you know? That, so he has to keep that in the back of his mind, too. And so it's just, it's,
can I just add one thing? Give me 20 seconds here just to make this point if I could.
Sure.
They're stuck. They're, you know, when things go bad, they could keep going bad. And they seem to put themselves, I've put themselves in a more difficult position than you would want to be in. And my point is this. DeBrincat, I feel, is one of the top goal scorers in the game. I'd say as much, an elite goal scorer. DeBrincat is not Artemi Panarin. Panarin is an elite goal scorer who could create space for himself to score goals. Now, if you're going to let Kane go bye-bye, that has to affect DeBrincat because you don't have anybody else. Well, there's really I don't know who you want to compare to Kane, but you don't have anyone close to that. And he has a lot to do with the production of DeBrincat. That's not to say that DeBrincat isn't an elite goal scorer in the NHL. DeBrincat is Brett Hull. He finds the soft spots and is not afraid. He's and more so than Brett Hull. He'll initiate contact even, but he finds soft spots on the ice, great vision, extremely smart, and has a great touch. Extremely valuable. But he's not the guy that's going to dance around, create space, go to the net. That's not him. Now, you have that with the best lateral guy going sideways, stick handling, everything else in Kane. If you're not going to keep one, you got to get rid of both. So otherwise, you're going to wind up with Kane, who will get disgusted and maybe want to leave next year, the following year for nothing. You get nothing for him. And DeBrincat, he's going to go where he needs to go to make the most money that he can, and justly so. Because if you look at him, what he's been able to do here is really outstanding. Because when you're on a one-line team, which they've been, it's tougher. You get the matchup, you get the top pairing guys against you. It's not as easy. There's no offset here. There's no they don't know who to send out because we have another line that's almost as good. No. They know what they need to do. They need to shut down Kane and DeBrincat. For both of them to put up those numbers, it's a testament to how good they are. But without Kane, DeBrincat will struggle to some degree, no doubt.
For sure, because even if Lucas Reichel becomes the player that you want him to be, he's more of a north-south guy. Whereas Kane. The remarkable thing, I mean, you can't say enough good things about the way Patrick Kane can play on the ice is how he can slow everything down from the wing, keep defenders at bay, and create time and space for other people. Whereas Reichel is,
he's a fast player. He's going to play an up-tempo game. And I don't know that he and DeBrincat are an exact match for each other. But yeah,
he gets comfortable. DeBrincat's contract's up, isn't it?
Well, yeah, DeBrincat's in a contract year next year. I mean, that's the other thing too. It's like, if you're okay, let's say
RFA then a UFA, RFA with arbitration, and then a UFA, right? So that's what I mean. Where
you
going?
You have Kane, Taves, and DeBrincat all in contract years, and like, if they're around, like, how bad are you going to be? Like, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I believe that they desperately want Taves to ask for a trade. I believe that, and they'll retain half of that salary for the 1 year to do it. I'm not sold that they want Kane to go, and I don't think Kane wants to go.
You know what, Chris? Let me ask you this. Would you pay? I guess it matters on the return. You'd pay $5 million to get rid of Jonathan Taves? That's what you'd basically be doing. I mean, my thinking is this. And again, sometimes I look at him on TV, and you brought it up. He looks like one of those prisoners of war from the Vietnam War sometimes. I don't know, you know, I hope it's not something mentally, whatever, or maybe he's just so disenchanted or he doesn't know which way is up because he was sick for the – I don't know, but if he could be your third line center, which great players end up being that, guys that he idolized end up being third line centers, you're not going to pay him $10.5 million again, but you could pay him for a couple, 3 more years if you think he's going to stay healthy for 3 more years at a reduced rate.
I would
do that,
though.
But now you're going to give up on him. I don't know what he would do, but you're going to give up on him now. Which I can understand, cost you $5 million, and now he goes somewhere else after he's missed the entire previous year.
Well,
I don't know.
Here's the thing.
I think
here's
I might hold
out. And, you know, here's the thing, and Taves kind of – one of the interviews that he did, and I don't know if we talked about this last time or not, but what is true is – I mean – Think about where we were a year ago, where we didn't know if Taves was ever going to play again, right? That at least that was what we were being told. Not sure if he'll ever play again. Not sure if he'll ever be the same. Not sure if he can even withstand that, like, play every night. Like, remember all that talk, remember? And then all of a sudden he showed up at the practice facility and he was practicing. And they, you know, the timing of that was weird, too, because that was after the John Doe at the time lawsuit, it was surfacing, and all of a sudden, oh yeah, Kane or Taves is skating. And not only did he step in and play, but he was playing 18, 19 minutes a night, every night, never took a night off till he got hurt. And what is true is it is really difficult to maintain. Like players don't build bulk or work on their physical weaknesses. Like say if a guy's having, you know, needs to work on his explosiveness, that's not something that you can do during the season because you're just working at maintaining your levels because of the grind. Everything is about recovery and just getting yourself back and ready to play. So with a full off season, let's say he's healthy, okay? There's no lingering effects. He's healthy. But he has a full off season to get himself right and where he wants to be. Whatever the best Jonathan Taves is at this point, whatever he has left, you're going to get it for the first 3 months at least of next season if he stays healthy. And it goes to the point of, like, at what point are you going to be able to move him? Is there going to be a general manager out there that's confident enough in him at this point that they're just going to make the deal over the summer and risk it? Or are the other GMs that are looking at him saying, well, we want to see how he comes back next year? Because this year's Taves is okay, but he's only going to be on a great team. He's only going to be your third line center with, you know, the ability to move up and play big minutes because of who he is when there's injuries.
And he has to okay the trade.
He has to okay the trade. And if he has to prove it, so to speak, then you, again, like, you're having these players that are in their contract years that Taves is playing, maybe playing to get traded to a better situation. For the first 3 months of the season, like, these are the effects of, you know, if Taves plays great, well, that's great. You're going to be able to trade him, but you're also winning games that maybe the organization would wish that you weren't winning because you want to have a great draft pick. It's just very bizarre, and they're really, I mean, they really are in a tough situation. I'm not even being, you know, it's just an observation. I'm not being critical.
And you can make the case that they had a worse year this year than last year, and he played this year.
Well, the other thing, too, I want to make about DeBrincat is I agree with a lot of what you said about DeBrincat, but I would also say, outside of the goals, I thought he had a better year the previous season. All around his aggressiveness on the forecheck, the bat, his all-around game, I thought was better last year. And that's
he's another
too.
Guy that went out. He went off the rails the last 4 or 5, 6 weeks too.
I thought you know that one time that Derek King, after I forget what loss it was, and he said we have guys out there just playing for their numbers or whatever the gist of what he said was.
Yeah,
he wasn't wrong, but you know, hey Derek, you're the coach.
What else are you gonna play for? What else are you gonna play for at some point? I mean. The other thing King said that didn't make sense was when
that
kid Vlasic came up about passing, when he said it was nice to see someone from the back end that could make a pass, and he says it and everyone laughs at him, but that was true. You know, that's telling too. How could you go through a whole season and not a defenseman score a power play goal?
Well, you have a terrible power play. I mean, number one. But
go ahead. You were saying it.
Well, I just say for DeBrincat, it's important again with that guy. Like let's say, I mean, I don't know. Like I said before, it's very bizarre to think what does a rebuild look like if you don't trade two of those three guys, Jones, Kane, and DeBrincat. What does it look like? Because what do you need them around here for if you're not going to be good in 4 or 5 years till 4 or 5 years from now. But if DeBrincat's the guy that stays, you need good coaching for him because he's still at, you know, 24, 25 years old. He's still at an impressionable age where, you know, he could develop bad habits and never really get out of them, or he'll have to be traded to you know, some guys need, you know, there are players in defensive to an extent with, the Bowman regime, when people talk about prospects and how they moved on and they got better. I mean, the fact of the matter is some young players need an organization to give up on them to get sort of scared straight. That's a real thing. I just keep going back to the coaching because the Blackhawks have had bad coaching for so long that people just don't even think about it anymore, you know? And it's such a huge part of, like, great coaching won't make you good on its own, but bad coaching will make you really bad.
Did you read the article, Chris, about the Kit Templey, the forward in Rockford?
Yeah, Scott Powers wrote an article about Michael Templey.
Yeah. Now, to me, and this is no slight on the article or anything, it is what it is. When the goalie coach, who's become the interim assistant coach, has to be the one to steer a forward on the right path, sirens, red flags, you know, should go off. That should scare fans.
Well, you know what should really scare, because Scott didn't connect these dots, but in his article, but you know who was coaching? Like, so the gist of the article for people that didn't read it is Michael Templey, a right wing, right-handed shot forward, tall guy, you know, maybe 6'2", 6'3", lanky, hasn't filled in. I wrote about Templey. It wouldn't be hard to go back and find it. If you just go on my website, it's there. in a really long thing where I was just talking about a lot of different stuff, I wrote about Tepley. I was watching a bunch of Ice Hogs games when I got sick there in end of March, early April. And I was watching him, and Tepley reminds me a little bit of Troy Brouwer. And I think it's probably a good comparison for the trajectory too, because Troy Brouwer, when he first started out, I mean, he was really a rough skater, really awkward, but he did have good hands. But you just thought, like, and when people going back to that, when they were in Norfolk, when the minor league team was in Norfolk, I would just tell people, like, yeah, he'll never make it because he can't skate, you know, but he worked on it and he got it there. Tepley can skate a little bit, but it's probably a good comparison. I wouldn't count on it because, I mean, just look at, I mean, where are the Blackhawks right now? They're looking for forwards that can play at a high pace, skate real well. Tepley's not that. So very much a long shot. But the point is, who was, when Tepley started out as Scott's, the first part of the season, he didn't have any points. He wasn't doing anything at all. And he was really, really struggling. Who is his coach? Like, who is the assistant coach that was working with him? It was Anders Sorensen. Anders Sorensen gets promoted to the head coach, and Tepley's still struggling. So Sorensen's got different duties. He's in, you know, like the dynamic of how you work with players is different when you're the head coach. And so he assigns Aubrey because Aubrey's one of the bench coaches. Jared Nightingale, who they eventually hired, obviously Jared's working with the defense. So Aubrey's got to work with the forwards. Well, he starts working with a goalie and he turns himself around. To me, that's funny because it's as much of a knock on Sorensen as it's, you know, a plus for Aubrey. But yes,
plus
very
the whole
bizarre
organization, right? I mean, we mentioned the tough spot Davidson's in. And if you listen to him talk, he readily admits there's things in.
Uh-oh.
And dropped out there. Sorry about that. I was saying Davidson readily admits there's things in the organization that basically need an overhaul. I mean, he has so much work to do internally. You know, you talked about the Greenberg hire. That's supposed to be someone who's supposed to breathe some life into the organization, new methods, yada, yada, yada. But you got to get some bodies in here with experience. I mean, and he comes across, and maybe they have a plan and it's already filled out. And, you know, he comes across like, well, maybe probably July. If I'm him, any assistant out there with a team that's still not in the playoff hunt that you think could be a fit somewhere, you got to interview. And this stuff about having to broadcast everyone you interview, that's poor form. You know, people don't want their name maybe associated with getting turned down with jobs. It's hard enough to get a job, an NHL coaching job. And some of these assistants, they don't get much of a chance. They get a chance to basically freewheel it when their contract's up. Otherwise, you need permission to go and be able to talk to another team. And I've known of cases where assistants are turned down. They're not, even though it's, you know, it's not like the NFL, if it's supposed to be, you know, a promotion, you get to go basically. No, they don't have to let you out of a contract, and they're not going to do it during the year. And if you're important to them, you know, they may not do it at all. So, you know, I think I'd be, you don't want to rush it, but I would be out there actively talking to people now because you got a lot of holes to fill.
Yeah. And another point about Tepley, cause I got all of the Ice Hogs usage numbers it was the last week of the season. So they're not final, but it was the last week of the season. So it's pretty much all the, so let me pull it up here. So one of the things that article talked about was, and it's true that it really wasn't until Tepley got put with Reichel that things, you know, kind of switched around for him. Tepley, it really wasn't until January that he played with Reichel. It was when they came back from the COVID temporary shutdown there over the holidays. And, yeah, that's pretty much January 7th on. There's a couple of games where he sort of gets put. But, yeah, from that point on, he his most regular line mate or center was Reichel. And, yeah. So before that, he was playing with Slavin. He was a nice little player, Josiah Slavin. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of him. And one of the things I think with Slavin is, or just in general, is I would like to see the Ice Hogs going forward or the Blackhawks going forward, since they control everything that happens to Rockford, is find guys and play them together in Rockford who you see potentially playing together in Chicago, especially if you're going to be going through like this huge rebuild where there's going to be a lot of roster turnover, a lot of people. So play guys that you see, like legitimately see at least getting a shot at the NHL level, play them together in Rockford. So when they come up, they can play together at the NHL level too. So maybe it helps them out. It's a little easier transition for them. And obviously you want to put them with somebody who's got a lot of NHL experience, because you don't want to have like three rookies on the same line. But I'd like to see them do a little bit more of that. Cause there was times when Reichel and Slavin were together. And I really like that combination, but they didn't really stay together. The other thing, too, that I wanted to point out on these charts is a lot of talk about the defense in Rockford, and some of this has probably been said before, but yeah, Kalnuk did not have a good year and probably done with the organization. The names that people are talking about right now are Regula. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how excited you should be about him. He's okay, but, you know, all these guys, with the exception of Mitchell, they should all just be in Rockford next year. I mean, Mitchell's at the point where he's got to make the step. And if he can't make the step, then, you know, he either needs a change of scenery, maybe you get something for him, kind of like when the Blackhawks traded Clendenning to Vancouver for Gustav Forsling. You know, I wasn't a big fan of that trade, but I remember when they made that trade. I remember people like a couple of Blackhawks people telling me like, "No, wait till you see this guy. This is a great trade." They were really excited about that trade, and I watched Forsling and I was like, "Yeah, you know," but he wasn't as polished at that point. Not polished, but he hadn't had as much North American time as Clendenning at that point. But then you started watching, it's like, okay, I guess I can see it. You know, all right, you know, that was a good trade.
But they ruined him. They ruined him and Luda because they put them together. And, yeah, they made him top-pairing guys and put them in bad situations and talking about future Norris winners and way before their time. I mean, they're nice second-pair guys, you know, that could play on a good team. I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. You know,
right.
Maybe Ruda's a number four guy, a number four or five guy, but still, you know, still players. But
and to my point earlier about playing guys that they potentially see playing in the NHL together, I don't know this, but Ian Mitchell and Isaac Phillips, after like the first part of the year when the Blackhawks were still thinking that Nicholas Beaudin was a part of the future. And the first month of the season, Beaudin and Ian Mitchell were regular partners. Well, I don't know how regular. It's actually five games, but so I'm looking at it. I'm just scrolling through these numbers here. So
what was the downfall of Kalinuk?
I he's just a in their world. He's a tweener. There's nothing that
I liked him.
Yeah, I mean, he could be a guy that goes somewhere where he's actually coached and develops. But I was watching. He did not have a good playoff. That was definitely my evaluation. But Mitchell, 76% of his time, even strength was with Isaac Phillips. And Isaac Phillips, he's got potential, but these guys, there's no reason to rush. Regula, Phillips, if you still like Galvis, there's nothing really that Galvis does that excites me, but all these guys should be back around. There's no reason to rush these guys at all. They can come, I mean, Regula can come up and play minutes, but you're going to have injuries and stuff. But there's no, outside of Mitchell, it's time, you know, like you got to figure it out. Like, is he part of it or is he not? I mean, it's his time to come up and prove that one way or another. But yeah, there's not a whole lot in Rockford. I mean, that's the one thing I think when you read through sort of what Davidson is saying. I mean, it's encouraging that I think he's talking the defense up a little bit, but he doesn't really say much about the forwards, and that's a good thing because they don't really have anything there that at least at this point to get excited about.
Yeah, I mean,
and the other thing
usually,
too,
if you
that
look,
I'll say
I mean,
real quick is people. Sorry, one. I think I'll say real quick. No, there's also this. I've seen this where people are saying like they're talking about the Ice Hawks that they lost to the Wolves because the Wolves have an over bloated roster of veterans and stuff like that. That Chicago Wolves roster entirely controlled by the Carolina Hurricanes. This isn't the 10, 15, 20 years ago where the Wolves were independent or sort of independent and they brought in their own guys to go along with prospects from another. That roster's 100% controlled by Don Waddell. It's all Carolina prospects. And yes, they did go out and they do what, so the Blackhawks made, you know, they made a big deal about, oh, it's going to, so exciting that the Ice Hawks are going to have this playoff run, and it really means something. They didn't go out and get them any help. Davidson didn't add anybody to that roster to help the Ice Hawks compete in the postseason because the truth is they really didn't care. Yeah, they'll
take like when Colleton was there in his last year.
Exactly. When Colleton, well, it was his first year. When Colleton was there.
Well, I mean his last year in Rockford, right?
Right. When Colleton was there, Bowman got him all of the tools so he could give Colleton a chance to have the best playoff run he can because he had a motivation. It was because he saw Colleton as Quenneville's replacement, and they couldn't wait to get rid of Quenneville because the front office thought that they were smarter than Quenneville. That was what that whole thing was about. So they went out and they got players to give Rockford the best chance to have a run. They had a run, and boom, there you go. Colleton, as soon as they could sell it, he's up and he's the NHL coach. This year they didn't do any of that because they didn't really want to have a long run because now the Blackhawks own the Ice Hogs and they didn't want to eat all those losses financially.
And the other thing is they're stymied down there too. What are you going to do? You want to keep King with the organization. You can't keep him on the NHL bench and saddle him to a new coach. He's not going to be the coach unless someone has a brain injury or something. I don't know how that could be, but what are you going to do? You have to put him back in Rockford as the coach. I don't know what other position you could create for him as the head coach. EJ Raddick said it best. The day they fired Quenneville and they got Colleton into the position, he said, you know, a lot of strong-willed people, this and that. And he said, now the Blackhawks have a coach. They could tell what to do. Now, that's a guy, you know, he's East Coast-based mostly, but he's on TV every day, and he knows people, and he's wired in. And what he said was 1,000% true. They had a guy in place that they could tell what to do, that was going to take the job for whatever money and go with it, and they got what they wanted, and how did that turn out?
Well, it's so important, like, what lessons did Kyle Davidson really learn? Kyle Davidson, all he knows is what he learned under the learning tree of Stan Bowman, John McDonough, Al McIsaac, Barry Smith, who there are people in that organization over the years that would say to me, Barry Smith is going to ruin this organization. And You know, I mean, it's Stan leaned hard on Barry Smith and over the years. But that's who Davidson learned from. Those are the guys he learned from. So what lessons did he learn? What did he think were mistakes? And one of the things going forward is if he brings in another inexperienced coach or someone that he just, well, this, I mean, it's important to have synergy. It's important to feel like you connect with the coach and you have similar ideas and you can talk and that, but to, I mean, the idea that, you know, you're also going to coach the team from upstairs. That's a bad concept. Cause the players see through it. You just can't have it.
So the interesting thing is you're going to get someone. The interesting thing is when you have no experience or very little experience, does he go to a young guy with no experience in the NHL as being a head coach and maybe none behind the bench in the NHL? Or does he look to someone maybe with a bit stronger, with a much stronger resume, who obviously knows more about coaching than he does? See, I'm from the school that, you know, you surround yourself with strength. I would hope that's what he does. I would hope he doesn't reverse things, because there were two factions, at least, with the Quenneville thing, and he was on the outs with Bowman, and Barry Smith was a Bowman guy, and it was the kind of the battle there where, you know, they wanted to have their fingerprints or have like a, you know, a bug in the dressing room to kind of keep track of what Quenneville was doing. Quenneville did whatever he wanted to do, and he had the street cred to do it. You know, Antoine Vermette comes here because he's the best faceoff man in hockey, and then he plays him at wing for 80% of the time, and he never takes a faceoff. But that's what he could do. So it's like Bowman, you know, knew his place, and Bowman was a hole filler, which he did a pretty good job at, but he let Quenneville run with things for the most part. But then it became probably an ego thing, and the team wasn't doing as much. And I would just hope that he makes the right choice. But from the attitude that I'm seeing about, you know, July, if I'm him, I mean, there's teams looking for head coaches, you know, and they're all better destinations. For the most part, they're all better destinations than here. You know, like, for example, now Bruce Cassidy gets former Blackhawk. He gets a rap that, you know, his rap supposedly is that he might be kind of tough on the younger players. But that always seems to come out after the fact, right? Even though younger players like Pasternak and stuff developed under him. But now there's kind of rumblings that maybe something's got to give there, because him and Sweeney have been tied by the hip for about a dozen years. Now, if he were to get fired, there's a guy, I mean, probably the one of the top coaches in the NHL is the guy on Pittsburgh when it comes to playing a structured game, because they are able to do that no matter who gets hurt. It's just one of those things that, for whatever reason, they seem to breed those third and fourth line players internally, and they could come right in. And Sullivan knows how to use all those guys the right way. They don't seem to miss a beat. But Cassidy isn't too far off that either. You know, it's going to be interesting to see where they go with this and what they do. Now, I don't know every one of them, but I'm sure there's some assistant coaches that are due a chance that have done really well. Does he look towards one of those guys? But again, why wait if someone's available?
Right. I mean, maybe that's what it is, to be fair to Kyle, I guess. Maybe he has his eye on an assistant or two that he thinks are probably going deep into the playoffs, and that's why he's giving this July timeline. You know, and if the guy that he's looking at becomes available sooner, maybe it happens sooner. We'll have to wait and see. But it's incredibly important that they get to this coaching thing right. I don't care what anybody's timeline is. Timelines don't mean anything. Like if Kirby Dach and Lucas Reichel come back next year and are appreciably better players than they were this past year, you're already, you know, kickstarting your rebuild right there. If you have better coaching,
yeah.
You know, like, so the timeline really doesn't mean anything. Like, it's the players will develop the timeline. So if Arvid Soderblom, Rockford IceHogs goaltender from pretty much all the season, Colin Delia fell out of favor, and he's one of the guys they're looking for. I think he should spend at least the first half of next year in Rockford, just keep getting minutes and keep playing. You know, I think one of the things that someone was telling me was that Soderblom at the end of the year was kind of fatigued. He was tired. He hadn't played this much hockey ever, which is a really important point. So I think he should, first half of next year, he should be up. But let's say at some point the Hawks need him. He comes up and he's just playing great. I mean, this is what happens. Goalies are weird. You never know who's going to be your next great goalie. It happens every single year. If suddenly you've got DeBrinket, Reichel, Dach all having great years, Kane's still there, and you had a goalie that's on fire, and you have a competent coaching staff, suddenly you're flirting with the playoffs, right? Like, so it's just, I don't know.
At least playing meaningful games into March. You know, I mean, he's stuck in the middle, right? He's got to make a decision on the Kane, DeBrinket, Jones. He's got to make a decision, because if they go, then maybe he just goes out and gets a journeyman guy and puts him here with whoever. And then
first
you want him – because then you want to make sure you don't win enough, maybe. You know, and that's the way you do it. It's the goaltending. That's how you make sure you don't get too good, you know.
Right. And we said this before. I mean, I was talking to somebody about this recently, and it was like, if Kane walks into Davidson's office or Danny Wirtz's office tomorrow and says, I want out, okay, boom, you're tearing the whole thing down and starting over. But if he comes back in and says, yeah, I want to play my whole career here. I don't want to go anywhere else. I'm fine if we're not good for the next couple of years. But I want to resign.
I'll sign an extension now. I'll sign an extension now if you want to do it.
Yeah, well, that changes everything.
He could do that, right? Right?
Everything.
Yeah, I mean, he could give you – yeah, he could give you cost certainty, right? I mean,
yeah.
There's so many different ways this could go, you know, that people are looking for timeline on this and timeline on that, but you got to get the right people here to steer the ship. And
Davidson
and
these
and
guys,
let's face it, they're not here now.
One of the reasons why they're saying these things is to give themselves time, where they're not held accountable, right? Why hasn't Danny Wirtz taken a question from the media since the town hall? They don't want to be held accountable. Like, they want you to leave them alone and give them time to figure it out. And so they're pushing this thing off. But there are other factors that are going to determine this. I want to, before we move on, that Rockford IceHogs Chicago Wolves series. So the IceHogs played 5 playoff games. They had a really tight series with Texas where they scored 3 goals, and then they scored 4 goals against the Wolves, I think. So in 5 playoff games, they scored 7 goals. But one of the interesting things in the Wolves series is the only period that the IceHogs played well in was the second period. The IceHogs were outshot by the Wolves 54-13 in the first period over 3 games. I mean,
that's all?
Yeah, I mean, it's really one of the stories of the Blackhawks organization in the last 4 years is why are they so poor? I mean, why are they so bad at the start of games? And, you know, it comes down to coaching, really, is what it is, you know, because players can bounce back and, you know, they have pride. They can bounce back and, you know, the ebb and flow of a game. But in the periods where it mattered, first period and the third period, they were outshot 54-13 and 44-21. In 3 games, they are outshot by 61 against the Wolves. It was just two completely different classes of players, groups of players.
Yeah, and so it's like the excuses they give after the games with the Hawks about how the second period is so bad. No, I mean, to be correct, every period is bad. The second period is just worse. You know, it's like none of the periods are good. You start off bad, too. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. But hopefully something good comes about. And I'm not looking, you know, I'm trying not to be destined to be negative with this, because one or two players, one or two pleasant surprises, a couple of people take a step forward, you get a coach in here, and at least you have something to watch. Because, you know, I saw all those cups, was there for almost all those games. But you know what a lot of the fun of it was? The anticipation. Like, I remember running to go see Jonathan Toews on TV, you know, in between periods. He was playing in a college game, you know. You think about all that stuff, the anticipation of what you think might happen. And then, I mean, it was a blessing, it turned out. But you just want something to look forward to. You don't want to be in the death spiral that you've been in.
Right. I think to analyze the fan base is they're looking for anything to be excited about. They're looking for any excuse to be excited about this team that they're so emotionally invested in. So, yeah, I mean, you don't want to be stuck in this position that they've been in where it's like you're just out of the playoffs and no hope. So that's why people are on board for a theoretical rebuild, because it's something different. It's something to look forward to. And again, fantasy GMing is fun, but what does it even look like? And what are the likelihood? The Blackhawks are talking a big game about, oh, get on board, cause it's the ride will be worth it in the end. It's like there's a level of arrogance there. I mean, Danny Wirtz was born on third base. Like, He's never done anything to deserve the position that he's in, but that's fine. He's a Wirtz. That's Kyle Davidson. Yeah, I mean, he's been a part of the organization for a while. Does he really deserve this position? Did he really earn it? No, he's they're comfortable with him, so he got it, right? Okay, we'll see how he does. Norm McIver was demoted based on his performance. And I know some of this, that Norm McIver, It was his internal player evaluation. He missed on guys. He missed on a lot of guys, and that he was demoted. They didn't fire him, but they demoted him. They put him in a position really where basically he had to quit to save face. But he was demoted based on performance, and now he's back in a higher role than he left.
This goes back to what I was saying. This goes back to what I was saying to you about what I heard about how what developed was a couple of different factions. And Davidson was kind of on, not necessarily head bumping with Bowman, but not really akin to everything he was doing. And, you know, he was smart enough to see the handwriting on the wall probably and knew that Bowman was going to be gone, and he had a lot of ideas,
and he
got Danny Wirtz's ear.
He saw what happened with Danny Wirtz and Stan Bowman. And this is another thing, like, why you got to be suspicious of this whole thing is Danny Wirtz fell in love with Stan Bowman, let Stan Bowman do all
absolutely,
and now
the family, everyone, yeah.
Now he's enamored with Kyle Davidson. Like, are we supposed to trust Danny Wirtz's judgment? I don't think so. But
Norm McIver was kind of like on the same team as Danny Wirtz is what I heard. And you could see where the head bumping would come in, because him and Bowman obviously weren't seeing eye to eye perfectly. So it's interesting, the politics inside the room. But ultimately, you need some strong people in here that understand what's going on, who's had success, who came from successful organizations, who accomplished something. You know, that's what Danny Wirtz needs to find, because that will help him be better. Like, you know, interesting one is, and I said this a while back, but, you know, very strong personality, and right away people, oh, he's a dinosaur and all that. But, you know, when Burke, with Pittsburgh now, you know, with the new ownership,
they were talking today on NHL radio. I was listening, and one of the beat writers there, I think it was Rossi, said, it's kind of interesting, you know, that everybody else who's out of the playoffs, basically every team, had a press conference with management to kind of just kind of go over things or whatever. Not Pittsburgh. Now, the Kings haven't done that yet either. They haven't had one. But he was saying beside them, everybody else has had some sort of a presser with the GM or president of hockey ops and kind of gone over things. Now, you wonder, are they all in meetings internally because there's a new ownership, you know, group involved? Will Brian Burke survive this? Will Hextall survive this? I mean, you know, there's a lot of unknowns there. Again,
well, I mean, the point about,
you know,
like, so like having different voices in the room, the voice that matters the most is Danny Wirtz's, right? Like, you know,
they have it structured that way.
Well, right. So if you brought in an older guy with different, like, it's still at the end of the day, you're sitting there, Kyle Davidson, Danny Wirtz is sitting there, and you have someone on the staff that has knowledge, that has experience. They have some good ideas and they have some bad ideas. It's Kyle Davidson, Danny Wirtz's job to be the filter and be the voice at the end. And if you're at the top and you don't want dissenting views, that's a weakness. It's a weakness of the person on the top. There's no other way to look at it. You know, that's
1,000% correct. And the structure of layering, you know, having so many people at different tiers, what that does is it protects those above because there's more people to point a finger at. This stuff of collaborative efforts, yeah. But in the same regard, that deflects blame also. Well, we all were in the meetings. We all thought this. We, you know, it was a collaborative effort. They need someone who's got a set of nuts on them and could talk and isn't afraid of losing the job and hire him as a consultant. I mean, is Stan's dad, is Scotty still on the payroll? I mean, maybe
I don't think he will be right. July 1st, but he is right now, yeah.
Right, but I'm saying, though, pay a guy a good amount of money. You want him heavily involved. Have him come in and assess the situation and not take 2 years to assess it. So you need someone who's not afraid, okay, and is not afraid of losing a job and knows what he's doing, a Brian Burke type or someone like that. Put him in here. I don't know what title you give him. That seems to be an important thing. Just call him a consultant, senior advisor to the president, whatever you want to call him. But get someone in here that could, with fresh eyes, that could help you, who has experience. You've got some good younger people, hopefully, supposedly. Balance it out a little bit.
Yeah, I think people, that scares people because they, you know, because of the inexperience of Davidson and Wirtz and Greenberg, that they'd be impressionable, that if you brought in somebody, a strong personality, that they would learn in other people's, you know, the people that don't like that idea, the dissenters would be like, well, they're going to learn the wrong things from those people. It's like, well, you know,
who are they learning from now?
And
themselves?
If they're smart enough hockey minds to be the general manager and the associate general manager of an NHL hockey team, they should be able to see through good ideas and bad. And
they shouldn't be afraid. They shouldn't be afraid. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
so
what's a strong,
right, having a strong-minded, experienced coach or assistant coach or advisor to hockey ops shouldn't be a negative. It shouldn't be something to be concerned about. It should be something that you have in place, and it strengthens the overall operation. And if you're running from it, it's because, you know, you're just weak. You know, you have a weak structure. I think we're going to – let me see here. Okay, so we can – all right, I want to wrap up here, but we're still recording. So yes. Okay. So I want to wrap up here, but one of the things I want to talk about, that the article, I can't stop here without at least mentioning it. So on April 15th on thethirdmanin.com, puckchatter.com, I wrote that article. I went back and reread the Jenner and Block report. You know, I read it the first time, and I think like a lot of people that read it the first time or skimmed over it the first time, which I'm guessing most people didn't read the whole thing. It's fine. It was rough. It's rough to read, and it's sort of, you know, it's a tough thing to go through. But one of the things that really kind of stuck out to me at first, but it wasn't like the most, you know, like shocking thing in the article. So it didn't really, I didn't completely get focused on it the first time, but when I went back and reread it, it's this passage in the Jenner and Block report that in September of 2013, that they actually got a phone call from the police department in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, that Brad Aldrich was being investigated for sexually assaulting a hockey player at the time who was a minor. And they called the Blackhawks. According to the report, according to Marie Cetera, who was the Blackhawks HR director at the time, she left during the course of the Jenner and Block investigation, called from Michigan, said that he had heard that there were issues between Aldrich and a couple of former Blackhawk players, which to me is like, wow. Like, how did he know? Like, where did he get this information? And, of course, Marie Cetera did what she's supposed to do. She said, I can only confirm that he's – I mean, this is any – if you don't understand this aspect of HR, you don't just start gossiping or disclosing information that you don't have to disclose. It opens you up to liability. You just say, yes, that person worked here. This is the timeline. This is when they left. That's it. Any other information you need, you're going to need to, you know, subpoena. She did exactly what she was supposed to do. There's nothing wrong with what Marie Cetera did in that situation. But what happened in that moment was that the Blackhawks were tipped off that Brad Aldrich was about to be arrested. Point about the Blackhawks, and we really should do another podcast and spend more time on this. But just glancing over this, I want to say this. My problem, my biggest issue with the Blackhawks and the way they handled this is not, yes, in the moment in May of 2010, they didn't handle it great. But I can understand why hockey people on the eve of going into the Stanley Cup final handled it the way that they did. Okay. It's not right, but I could like, okay. And then the greater context, which no one wants to talk about, was that by that point, Kyle was already on the wrong side of the front office, because it was the previous spring that Kyle and Akeem Alou got into a fight at the hotel in Milwaukee when they were up with the Rockford IceHogs. And they both had to be sent home. He was already someone who was – they had already had problems with – he was already on the wrong side of management. So now on the eve of going into the playoffs, this awful thing happens to him, but none of them wanted to deal with it, right? There's that quote that is alleged from Stan and the mental skills, James Gary, the mental skills doctor, that Bowman is quoted by them in the meeting is saying, we can't deal with this right now. Okay. Yes, it's bad. If he really did say that, it's bad, but I don't know what anyone would expect a hockey coach to say in that situation. Should they have done more? Yes. But what really bothers me about the whole situation is that at every opportunity after that, after the playoffs are over, after the Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup, at every chance after that, every opportunity the Blackhawks had to do the right thing, they did the opposite. And look no further, because a lot of this, what some people don't understand is, I don't know that any of this happens if they don't just go, Stan Bowman, Joe Quenneville, McIsaac, McDonough, whoever, just go to Kyle in September of 2010 and sit him down and say, Kyle, we're really sorry. We're really sorry that this happened to you. We're really sorry that, say to him, whatever you need from us, we will help you. However you want us to guide you, or if we want you, you can get independent counseling, whatever you want. If they would have just done that, quite possibly none of this scandal all these years later ever happens. But the other thing that's really just really gets me is how in September of 2013, when they get this phone call that Brad Aldridge is about to be arrested for allegedly sexually assaulting, but he was convicted. He pleaded guilty and was convicted. A kid. What was their instinct? Their instinct was not to go to Kyle, who was still right there in Chicago and Rockford, and say, Kyle, sit down. We need to talk. And tell Kyle, this is what we've heard is happening, and sit him down and prepare him for that news. Because if you're the Blackhawks, you would have had to have presumed that story was going to get out. And that's a whole other issue with this whole Brad Aldridge thing that is very, very mysterious, is how that never got out. How three different outlets in the Upper Peninsula reported on this but never mentioned his former employers. When they knew that Brad Aldridge worked for the Blackhawks, because they at least two of those outlets did articles when he brought the cup back home to the Upper Peninsula. That's wild to me. But in 2013, how they don't sit Kyle Beach down and say, Kyle, this is what's happening. We want you to know. We want you to hear from us. We're really sorry. And whatever you need from us, you need to take time off. You need to take a leave of absence. You want to talk to someone. You want to, why that didn't happen to me is abhorrent and is the worst aspect of this story. And now, full disclosure, that article, and I've been dormant for a long time, that article on April 15th, 2022, is the most read article that I've ever written, that I can tell. And nobody in Chicago wants to touch it. Because, but that aspect of that story, and you can't tell me that Rocky Wirtz by that point didn't know. And I alluded to this when we did our last podcast, that there was an element of that Jenner and Block report that it absolutely strains any credulity that Rocky Wirtz in September of 2013, when his director of HR gets called that, hey, your former employee is about to be arrested for sexually assaulting a minor. And you know that not just two different players, but staff had stories that he was inappropriate with them, right? How that didn't make it up the chain to Rocky Wirtz in 2013 is there's no way. There's absolutely no way Rocky didn't know. And how did that organization run by Rocky Wirtz handle that situation? They didn't tell, apparently, because Kyle said that he didn't find out till 2019. How they didn't sit him down and prepare him for that news is the worst thing that they did in this whole saga. The absolute worst thing. Because, he's at that point, if you had any doubt, and I'm sure they had doubts, there are people there that didn't believe him. That's part of the story that's also it's there, that they didn't believe him. But at that point, even if you didn't believe him, even if you didn't believe his story, even if you thought there were aspects of the story that, whatever, at that point, to not have compassion, enough compassion for Kyle Beach to sit him down and say, Kyle, we're really sorry. And what do you need from us? We want you to hear this from us. So when the story comes out, you're not blindsided by it. And they didn't do it. And not only did they not do it, but they sent him to Sweden. Mind-boggling. And I know a lot of people they're done talking about this. They don't want to talk about it anymore. But it's crazy to me. And I don't know. I think I lost Al. Let's see if Al is still with us or not. Okay. I don't know if Al can come back or not. But that I just wanted to get that off my chest. Let's try to get Kyle or Al back. One second. Maybe I can't do that. Okay, can't do that. All right, so that'll be it then. But yeah, I just wanted to get that off my chest and say that because I know I had a lot of great responses and to that article and I know it's not a subject that's fun to talk about or even if people really seem to be that interested in it anymore for whatever reason. But yeah, and the other aspect of that story that I noted is that Norm McIver was the assistant general manager when in September 2013 when the Blackhawks decided that when they got that news and they decided to send Beach to Sweden. Now, maybe Norm had no idea and he was just, hey, we're going to do this thing and no one clued him in. I don't buy it, but I'm not advocating that Norm should lose his job or anything, but the Blackhawks at some point, they have a consistent, the one thing that they're consistent is, and all of this is not telling the truth, or not being more forthcoming. And, you know, I don't know. It's just, I know a lot of people are struggling with their Blackhawk fanaticism. If you're listening to this right now, you're probably not struggling with it that much. You're probably still on board, but, I don't blame anybody either way for it. It's sports, but that part of that story, absolutely terrible. And to me, it's the worst aspect of it because it's a coordinated effort to cover it up, really, essentially. And so anyway, thanks everybody for listening. I'll say goodbye for Al. He dropped off. I think he had to go do something. We'll do this again at some point. I think Al likes doing them. He asked me to do it every once in a while. So, again, everybody, enjoy Memorial Day weekend's coming up. Enjoy the holidays, and maybe we'll talk to you sometime in June. Enjoy the NHL playoffs, and good night, everybody.